shouted with excitement. The bottom of their boat was covered with what he described as small clams. He quickly pulled one off and ate it, pronouncing it a most delicious and agreeable food. Actually not clams, these were gooseneck barnacles. Unlike the whitish, cone-shaped barnacles commonly seen on dock pilings and ships, goosenecks are stalked barnacles, with a dark brown shell surrounding a fleshy, pinkish-white neck. A medieval myth claimed that once these barnacles grew to a sufficient size, they would transform themselves into geese and fly away. Today, the Coast Guard uses the size of the gooseneck barnacles growing on the bottom of a derelict craft to determine how long the vessel has been at sea. They can grow to half a foot in length, but the barnacles on Chase's whaleboat were probably not much more than a few inches long. Soon, all six men were plucking the crustaceans off the boat's bottom and popping them into their mouths like a set of gluttons. Gooseneck barnacles have long been considered a delicacy in Morocco, Portugal, and Spain, and are farmed commercially today in the state of Washington. Connoisseurs who eat the tube-like neck only after peeling off the outer skin compare the taste to crab, lobster, or shrimp. The Essex men, not as discriminating, consumed everything but the shells. After having satisfied the immediate craving of the stomach, Chase wrote, we gathered large quantities and laid them up in the boat. But getting the men back aboard proved a problem. They were too weak to pull themselves over the gunwale. Luckily, the three men who couldn't swim had elected to remain on the boat and were able to haul the others in. They had intended to save the uneaten goosenecks for another day, but after less than a half hour of staring at the delectable morsels, they surrendered to temptation and ate them all. Except for flying fish, gooseneck barnacles would be the only marine life the Essex crew would manage to harvest from the open ocean. Indeed, these 20 whalemen were singularly unsuccessful in catching the fish that castaways normally depend on for survival. Part of the problem was that their search for the band of variable winds had taken them into a notoriously sterile region of the Pacific. For an ocean to support life, it must contain the nutrients necessary for the production of phytoplankton, the organism at the base of the ocean's food chain. These nutrients come from two places: the land, through rivers and streams, and from the organic material on the ocean floor. The region into which the Essex crew had now ventured was so far removed from South America that the only source of nutrients was at the bottom of the sea. Cold water is denser than warm water, and when the surface waters of the ocean cool in the winter months, they are replaced by the warmer water underneath, creating a mixing action that brings the nutrient-rich waters at the bottom up to the surface. In the subtropical region, however, the temperature is fairly constant throughout the year. As a result, the ocean remains permanently divided into a warm upper layer and a cold lower layer, effectively sealing off the bottom nutrients from the surface. Over the next few decades, seamen became well aware that the waters in this portion of the Pacific were almost devoid of fish and birds. In the middle of the 19th century, Matthew Fontaine Maury compiled a definitive set of wind and current charts based largely on information provided by whalemen. In his chart of the Pacific is a vast oval-shaped area, stretching from the lower portion of the offshore ground to the southern tip of Chile, called the Desolate Region. Here, Maury indicates, mariners report few signs of life in sea or air. The three Essex whaleboats were now in the heart of the Desolate Region. Like Pablo Valencia, they had journeyed into their very own valley of death. The calm continued into December 15th, the 24th day of the ordeal. Despite the windless conditions, Chase's boat was taking on even more water than usual. Their search for the leak once again prompted them to pull up the floorboards in the bow. This time they discovered that a plank next to the keel at the very bottom of the boat had pulled loose. If they had been on the deck of the Essex, they would have simply flipped the boat over and re-nailed the plank. But now in the middle of the ocean, they had no way of reaching the underside of the boat. Even Chase, whom Nickerson described as their boat's doctor, could not figure out a way to repair it. After a few moments' consideration, the 21-year-old boat steerer Benjamin Lawrence ventured a proposal. He would tie a rope around his waist and dive underwater with the boat's hatchet in his hand. As Chase hammered in a nail from the inside of the boat, Lawrence would hold the hatchet against the outside of the plank. When the tip of the nail hit the metal face of the hatchet, it would curl up like a fish hook and be driven back into the boat. The last blows of Chase's hammer would set the head of the nail while drawing the planks tightly together. This was known as clenching a nail and was usually performed with a tool known as a backing iron. For now, the hatchet would have to do. On the Essex, Lawrence's abilities as a boat steerer had been called into question, and he had been forced to surrender the harpoon to his demanding first mate. This time, however, it was Lawrence to whom Chase and the rest of the boat crew looked for guidance. Chase readily agreed to the plan, and soon Lawrence was in the water, pressing the hatchet up against the bottom of the boat. Just as he had predicted, the sprung plank was drawn in snug. Even Chase had to admit that it answered the purpose much beyond our expectations. The oppressive conditions continued through the next day and bore upon our health and spirits with an amazing force and severity. Some of the men experienced thirst-induced delusions. The most disagreeable excitements were produced by it, Chase commented, which added to the disconsolate endurance of the calm, called loudly for some mitigating expedient, some sort of relief to our prolonged sufferings. The need for action intensified when the noon observation revealed that they had drifted 10 miles backward in the last 24 hours. All around them, the unruffled ocean reached out to the curved horizon like the bottom of a shiny blue bowl. Their parched mouths made talking, let alone singing hymns, difficult. The prayer meetings, along with their progress, ceased. That Sunday, they sat silently in their boats, desperate for deliverance, knowing that back on Nantucket, thousands of people were sitting on the wooden benches of the North and South meeting houses, waiting for God's will to be revealed. At worship, a Quaker sought to center down, shutting out all worldly cares in his attempt to find the divine spirit. When a person was moved to speak, he chanted in a peculiar way, a kind of half-singing, half-sobbing that could break into more natural speech. Although only a few of the Essex crew were active Quakers, all of the Nantucketers had at one time or another attended a meeting. The protocol and rhythms of a friend's meeting were part of their shared cultural heritage. Up until this point, it had been the African Americans, specifically the 60-year-old Richard Peterson, who had led the men in prayer. This was not uncommon at sea. White sailors often looked to blacks and their evangelical style of worship as sources of religious strength, especially in times of peril. In 1818, the captain of a ship about to go down in a North Atlantic gale beseeched the black cook, a member of New Bedford's Baptist Church, to seek the Lord's help on the crew's behalf. The cook knelt down on the tossing deck and prayed most fervently for God to protect and save us from the dreadful raging storm. The ship survived. But that afternoon, it was Pollard who was finally moved to speak beneath the punishing sun. His voice ravaged by dehydration, he proposed in a halting rasp that they attempt to row their way out of the calm. Each man would be given double rations during the day, and then that night they would row until we should get a breeze from some quarter or other. All readily agreed to the proposal. At last, after days of being stuck as if pinned to a place in the ocean, with nothing to distract them from their thirst and hunger, they had something to prepare for. They ate the bread and felt every sublimely refreshing drop of water seep into their cracked and shriveled mouths. They looked forward to the night ahead. Under normal circumstances, rowing was a task that helped define each man's worth on a whale ship. Each crew took pride in its ability to row effortlessly for hours at a time, and nothing made the men happier than passing another boat. But that night, any flickering of those competitive fires was soon extinguished. Though in their teens and twenties they rowed like old men, wincing and groaning with every stroke. For the last 3 weeks their bodies had been consuming themselves. Without any natural padding to cushion their bones, they found the simple act of sitting to be a torture. Their arms had shrunk to sticks as their muscles withered, making it difficult to hold, let alone pull, the oars. As man after man collapsed in a slumped heap, it became impossible to continue. We made but a very sorry progress, Chase remembered. Hunger and thirst and long inactivity had so weakened us that in 3 hours every man gave out, and we abandoned the further prosecution of the plan. Air rattled in their desiccated throats and lungs as they lay panting in the boats. Despite the raging heat of their bodies, their thin, papery skin was without a hint of perspiration. Gradually, the noise of their breathing ebbed, and they were once again deafened by the forbidding silence of a windless and empty ocean. The next morning they detected a change, a rustling of the water and a movement across their faces, as for the first time in 5 days, a light breeze poured out across the sea. Even though it was from precisely the wrong direction, southeast, the men welcomed it with almost frenzied feelings of gratitude and joy. By noon, it was blowing a gale. The wind had veered into the east-southeast, and once again they were forced to take in all sail and lower the masts. The next day the wind moderated, and soon their sails were pulling them along. Despite the improvement in the weather, that night proved to be, Chase recalled, one of the most distressing nights in the whole catalog of our sufferings. They now knew that even if the wind did miraculously shift into the west, they no longer had enough water to last the 30 or more days it would take to sail to the coast of Chile. Their physical torments had reached a terrible crescendo. It was almost as if they were being poisoned by the combined effects of thirst and hunger. A gluttonous and bitter saliva collected in their mouths that was intolerable beyond expression. Their hair was falling out in clumps. Their skin was so burned and covered with sores that a splash of seawater felt like acid burning on their flesh. Strangest of all, as their eyes sunk into their skulls and their cheekbones projected, they all began to look alike, their identities obliterated by dehydration and starvation. Throughout this long and dismal week, the men had attempted to sustain themselves with a kind of mantra. Patience and long-suffering was the constant language of our lips, Chase remembered, and a determination, strong as the resolves of the soul could make it, to cling to existence as long as hope and breath remained to us. But by the night of December 19th, almost precisely a month since the sinking of the Essex, several of the men had given up. Chase could see it in their lagging spirits and worn-out frames, an utter indifference to their fate. One more day, maybe two, and people would start to die. The next morning began like so many others. Nickerson recalled how at around 7 o'clock they were sitting in the bottom of our little boat, quite silent and dejected. 19-year-old William Wright from Cape Cod stood up to stretch his legs. He glanced to leeward, then looked again. "There is land," he cried. Chapter 9. The Island. The men in Chase's boat stared eagerly ahead. Ravaged by hunger and thirst, half blinded by glare from the sea and sky, they had seen mirages before, and they feared this might prove to be another. But all of them could see the white sandy beach in the distance. It was no visionary delusion, Nickerson wrote, but in reality, land ho. Even the most decrepit of Chase's men sprang to life. "We were all aroused in an instant," the first mate remembered, "as if electrified. A new and extraordinary impulse now took possession of us. We shook off the lethargy of our senses and seemed to take another and a fresh existence." At first glance, the island bore an eerie resemblance to their native Nantucket, a low rise of sand topped with green. Chase called it a basking paradise before our longing eyes. Nickerson immediately assumed that it marked the final end to our long confinement and sufferings, and added, "Never have my eyes rested on anything so pleasingly beautiful." It wasn't long before the men in the other two boats had seen the island. Spontaneous cheers rose up from their cracked and swollen lips. "It is not within the scope of human calculation," Chase wrote, "to divine what the feelings of our hearts were on this occasion. Alternate expectation, fear, gratitude, surprise, and exaltation each swayed our minds and quickened our exertions." By 11 o'clock, they were within a quarter mile of the island. They could now see that instead of sand, it was made mostly of rock, with 30-foot vertical cliffs lining the shore. Beyond the cliffs, the interior of the island was amazingly flat, yet fresh and green with vegetation. This boded well, they assured themselves, for the presence of ample supplies of water. Pollard and Chase studied their copies of Bowditch's Navigator. Judging from the day's previous observation, they determined it must be Ducie Island at latitude 24 degrees 20 minutes south, longitude 124 degrees 40 minutes west. After a month at sea, after traveling approximately 1,500 nautical miles, they were farther from the coast of South America than when they had started. The men's immediate concern was that the island might be inhabited. In our present state, Nickerson wrote, we could have made but feeble resistance to an attack from natives. Keeping about 100 yards from shore, they began sailing around the island. We frequently fired a pistol, Nickerson remembered, as we glided past some valley or nook in the woods to arouse its inhabitants, should there be any within hearing. But neither friend nor foe appeared. The island was an irregular oblong, about 6 miles long and 3 miles wide, rimmed by a jagged ledge of rocks and coral. The three boat crews gradually made their way to the north end, which put them in the lee of the southeasterly trades. At a bend in the shoreline, they found the island's largest beach. This seemed the most promising position we had seen, Nickerson wrote, to make an attempt to land with our boats. But first, Chase would lead a preliminary scouting party while the three boats stood offshore, just in case they should unexpectedly find savages in ambush. Chase, with musket in hand, and two others were dropped off on a large rock. By the time they'd waded ashore, they were already exhausted. Upon arriving at the beach, the first mate recalled, it was necessary to take a little breath, and we laid down for a few minutes to rest our weak bodies. They sat on the coarse coral sand, drinking in the sights and sounds of a stunningly beautiful island world. The cliffs behind them were festooned with flowers, shrubs, grasses, and vines. Birds flew about them, seemingly unconcerned by the men's presence. After a month of deprivation and suffering, they were about to enjoy, Chase was convinced, a rich banquet of food and drink. But first, they had to find a source of water. They split up, each one hobbling down the uneven beach in a different direction. In an inlet, Chase was able to spear an 18-inch fish with a ramrod of his musket. He dragged the fish onto the shore and immediately sat down to eat. His two companions joined him, and in less than 10 minutes the fish was consumed, bones and skin and scales and all. They now imagined they were strong enough to attempt a climb of the cliffs, which they figured to be the most probable source of water. But instead of rocks glistening with moisture, Chase found a dry, scrubby wall of dead coral. The shrubs and vines were not strong enough to support his weight, forcing him to grab the cutting edges of coral. Slashed and bruised, Chase realized he did not have the strength to reach the top. The euphoria of only a few hours before gave way to the realization that this sterile outcropping of fossilized sea organisms might be without drinkable water. If this was true, every second they remained on the island reduced their already slim chances of survival. No matter how tempting it might be to spend at least one night on solid ground, Chase's first inclination was to set sail for South America immediately. I never for one moment lost sight of the main chance, which I conceived we still had, of either getting to the coast or of meeting some vessel at sea. When he returned to the beach, he discovered that one of the men had some promising news. He had found a cleft in a rock that exuded the slightest trickle of water, just enough to wet his lips, but no more. Perhaps it was advisable to spend the night on the island and devote the next day to searching for water. Chase and his companions went out to the boats, and Chase told Pollard what he thought. They agreed to land. They dragged the boats up onto a grassy area beneath a stand of trees. We then turned the boats bottom upwards, Nickerson remembered, thus forming a protection from the night dews. The men fanned out along the shore, and after collecting a few crabs and fish, they settled down beneath the boats, ate their catch, then stretched out their bony limbs for the first time in a month. Sleep soon followed. Free from all the anxieties of watching and labor, Chase wrote, we gave ourselves up to an unreserved forgetfulness and peace of mind. Morning came quickly, and with it a return to the agonies of hunger and thirst. They were now so severely dehydrated that they had begun to lose the ability to speak. Relief, Chase wrote, must come soon or nature would sink. They wandered the beach like ragged skeletons, pausing to lean against trees and rocks to catch their breath. They tried chewing the waxy green leaves of the shrubs that grew in the cliffs, but they were bitter to the taste. They found birds that made no attempt to escape when they plucked them from their nests. In the crevices of the rocks sprouted a grass that, when chewed, produced a temporary flow of moisture in their mouths. But nowhere did they find fresh water. As soon as they strayed beyond the beach, they discovered that the island was a scrap heap of fractured coral as sharp and piercing as shattered glass. Many of the men had no shoes, which made it impossible for them to explore any great distance from their encampment. They also feared that if they did venture out, they might not have the stamina to return before nightfall, thus exposing themselves to attacks of wild beasts which might inhabit the island. That evening they returned, Nickerson wrote, sorrowing and dejected, to our little town of boats in the valley. But Pollard had a surprise for them. The captain and his steward, William Bond, had spent the day gathering crabs and birds, and by the time the men returned from their searches, Pollard and Bond were in the midst of roasting what Nickerson called a magnificent repast. Prior to the sinking, food had been a source of dissension between Pollard and his men. Now it was what brought them together, and this time it was the master who was serving his crew. Here everyone seated himself upon the beautiful green grass, Nickerson remembered, and perhaps no banquet was ever enjoyed with greater gusto or gave such universal satisfaction. Pollard had done everything he could that day to increase the health and morale of his men. Chase remained focused on the main chance, getting to South America and safety. Restless and impatient as always, he had become convinced that they were wasting their time on this island without water. In this state of affairs, we could not reconcile it to ourselves to remain longer at this place, he wrote. A day, an hour, lost to us unnecessarily here, might cost us our preservation. That evening, Chase expressed his concerns to Pollard. I addressed the substance of these few reflections to the captain, who agreed with me in opinion upon the necessity of taking some decisive steps in our present dilemma. While he agreed with his first mate in principle, Pollard attempted to defuse some of Chase's impetuousness. The captain pointed out that without a new supply of water, their chances of survival were next to nil. To push blindly ahead without exhausting every possibility of finding a spring would be a tragic mistake. After some considerable conversation on this subject, Chase wrote, it was finally concluded to spend the succeeding day in the further search for water, and if none should be found, to quit the island the morning after. The men of the Essex did not know that they were within just a few hundred miles of saving themselves. Pollard and Chase were mistaken as to their whereabouts. This was not Ducey Island, but rather Henderson Island, at virtually the same latitude but 70 miles to the west. Both islands are part of a group named for its most famous member, Pitcairn, an island whose history was inextricably linked with Nantucket. In 1808, a sealing captain from Nantucket named Mayhew Folger stumbled across Pitcairn, whose location was incorrectly recorded on all available navigational guides, and discovered the answer to a 19-year-old mystery. What had happened to Fletcher Christian and the Bounty? After abandoning Captain Bligh in the ship's launch in 1789, the Bounty mutineers had wandered the Pacific. They picked up some native women and a few men in Tahiti and eventually made their way to an uninhabited island in the southeastern extreme of Polynesia. In 1820, a small community of Bounty descendants was flourishing on Pitcairn. Just 400 miles to the southwest, a few days' sail from Henderson, they would have provided the Essex crew with all the food and water they needed. But Pitcairn was not listed in their bow ditch's navigator. Even if it had been, it's questionable whether they could have found it. As it was, they were off by almost 100 miles when they tried to determine their current location. Henderson Island began as a coral atoll about 370,000 years ago. 20,000 years later, volcanic activity associated with Pitcairn caused the land underneath the atoll to rise. Today, the cliffs of Henderson are between 30 and 35 feet high, and enclose a dry, fossil lagoon. Surrounded by a vast ocean, this uninhabited speck of coral might seem an unlikely source of anyone's salvation. As much as 65 inches of rain falls on Henderson each year. This water does not all run off into the sea or evaporate into the air. Much of it seeps down through the thin soils and layers of fossilized coral to a depth of a foot or so above sea level. Here it flows into a horizontal layer of fresh water, saturating the rock and sand. The fresh water, which is lighter than salt water, floats on the surface of the sea in the shape of a dome or lens beneath the island. But unless they could find a spring, all this groundwater would be of no use to the men of the Essex. They weren't the first to be enticed by Henderson and then cheated. Although they weren't aware of it, in the cliffs behind them was a cave in which lay 8 human skeletons. A medical examination performed on the bones in 1966 revealed that they were of Caucasian origin, which suggests that these unidentified people, like the Essex crew, had been shipwreck survivors. The examination also revealed that one of the skeletons had belonged to a child between 3 and 5 years old. All 8 people had died of dehydration. The next morning, December 22nd, the 31st since leaving the wreck, the men resumed their search for water. Some, like Nickerson, climbed into the cliffs. Others investigated the rocks along the beach. Chase returned to where they had found evidence of fresh water 2 days before. The rock was about a quarter mile from their encampment, and with a hatchet and an old rusted chisel, he and 2 others made their way across the sand. "The rock proved to be very soft," Chase wrote, "and in a very short time I had obtained a considerable hole, but, alas, without the least wished-for effect." As the sun rose in the sky, Chase continued to peck away at the rock, hoping that by deepening the hole he might establish a flow of water. "But all my hopes and efforts were unavailing," he remembered, "and at last I desisted from further labor and sat down near it in utter despair." Then he noticed something curious. On the beach, in the direction of the boats, 2 men were lugging a container of some sort. He was amazed to see them begin to run. "The idea suddenly darted across my mind," Chase wrote, "that they had found water and were taking a keg to fill it. Up in the cliffs, Nickerson had noticed the same display of extraordinary spirit and activity, and soon became part of a general rush for the beach. The man had, in fact, found a spring bubbling up from a hole in a large flat rock. The sensation that I experienced was indeed strange, and such as I shall never forget," Chase remembered. "At one instant I felt an almost choking excess of joy, and at the next I wanted the relief of a flood of tears." By the time Chase reached the spring, men had already begun to drink, eagerly filling their mouths with the miraculous nectar. Mindful that in their dehydrated condition it was dangerous to drink too much water too quickly, Chase exhorted them to sip only small quantities and to wait several minutes between drinks. But their thirst proved overpowering, and some of the men had to be held back. Despite the officers' best efforts, several of the crew thoughtlessly swallowed large quantities of water until they could drink no more. But the agonizing cramps Chase had warned against never came. It only served to make them a little stupid and indolent for the remainder of the day. Once everyone had been given a chance to drink, they began to marvel at their good fortune. The spring was so far below the tide line that it was exposed for just a half hour at dead low. At high tide, it was as much as 6 feet underwater. They had time to fill only 2 small kegs before the rock once again disappeared below the surf. After collecting more fish and birds, they sat down for the evening meal. With a dependable source of water and a seemingly bountiful supply of food, they now thought it possible to hold out indefinitely on the island. At the very least, they could stay at Henderson until they had recovered their strength and repaired their worn-out whaleboats for a final attempt at reaching South America. That night, they agreed to remain on the island for at least another 4 or 5 days before they decided whether it would be advisable to make any arrangement for a more permanent abode. Their stomachs full and their thirst slaked, they quickly drifted off into what Chase described as a most comfortable and delicious sleep. At 11 o'clock the next morning, they returned to the spring. They arrived just as the tide fell below the rock. At first, the water was somewhat brackish, raising fears that the spring was not as reliable a source of fresh water as they had at first thought. But as the tide continued to retreat, the quality of the water steadily improved. After filling their casks with about 20 gallons, they set out in search of food. Every spare moment of every day was, in Chase's words, employed in roving about for food. The evening hours proved the most productive, for it was then that the plump white birds, known as tropic birds, about the size of chickens, returned to shore to feed their young. Approaching stealthily, the men would pounce upon the birds with a stick and take them without difficulty. They were not the only ones who lay in wait for the tropic birds each evening. There were also what Nickerson called the man-of-war hawks. But instead of killing the tropic birds, the hawks had what scientists call a kleptoparasitic relationship with them, pecking their backs and beating them with their wings until the tropic birds disgorged the fish that had been intended for their young. With the regurgitated food in their beaks, the hawks would fly away, leaving, Nickerson observed, the young tropic birds supperless. The following day, December 24th, they detected an alarming change. Nickerson noticed that the birds, being so constantly harassed, began to forsake the island. That evening, some of the crew returned to camp, complaining that they had not been able to find enough to eat. In just 5 days, these 20 voracious men had exhausted their portion of the island. Every accessible part of the mountain, contiguous to us or within the reach of our weak enterprise, Chase wrote, was already ransacked for birds' eggs and grass, and was rifled of all that they contained. Deep in the desolate region, Henderson Island had never been rich in natural resources. Scientists believe that flora and fauna originally spread to the islands of the Pacific from the luxuriant margins of Southeast Asia, and Henderson is more than 9,000 miles from this source. Making it even more difficult for life to reach this isolated outcropping of coral is the direction of the prevailing winds and currents. Like the men of the Essex, birds and plant species had to fight their way upwind and upstream to reach Henderson. Moreover, the island is south of the Tropic of Capricorn, a relatively cool band of water that acts as a further barrier to the spread of tropical species. As a result, Henderson has always been a difficult place for man to live. The human colonization of the Pacific Islands appears to have followed a pattern similar to the spread of plants and birds. Moving from one stepping stone of an island to the next, people pushed out ever farther to the east and south. Archaeological digs on Henderson have revealed that man first arrived on the island sometime between 800 and 1050 AD. These first inhabitants established a settlement on the same beach where the Essex crew hauled up their whaleboats. In the few places where the soil allowed for it, they grew sweet potatoes. They fished with hooks made out of imported pearl shells. They buried their dead in slab crypts. But by 1450, they were gone, no longer able to scratch out a living on what is considered today the last pristine elevated limestone island in the world. There was no Christmas feast for the Essex crew. That evening, they found that a fruitless search for nourishment had not repaid us the labors of a whole day. Only grass remained, and that was not much relished, Chase wrote, without some other food. They began to entertain serious apprehensions that we should not be able to live long here. In less than a week, the Essex crew had accomplished what had taken their Polynesian predecessors at least 4 centuries. By December 26th, their 7th day on Henderson and their 35th since leaving the wreck, they had resolved to abandon this used-up island. In Chase's words, their situation was worse than it would have been in our boats on the ocean, because in the latter case we should be still making some progress towards the land while our provisions lasted. In preparation for their departure, they had already begun working on the whaleboats. "We nailed our boats as well as it was possible to do," Nickerson wrote, "with the small quantity of boat nails in our possession, in order to prepare them to stand against the boisterous elements which we were again to encounter." The coast of Chile was approximately 3,000 miles away, about twice as far as they had already sailed. Upon studying their copies of Bowditch's Navigator, they realized that Easter Island, at latitude 27 degrees 9 minutes south, longitude 109 degrees 35 minutes west, was less than a third of that distance. Although they once again knew nothing about the island, they decided to sail for it, belatedly realizing that the potential terrors of an unknown island were nothing compared to the known terrors of an open boat in the open ocean. Early in the day, all hands were called together, Nickerson remembered, for a last talk previous to taking a final departure. Pollard explained that they would be leaving the next day and that the boat crews would remain the same as they'd been prior to their arrival on Henderson. It was then that 3 men came forward, Joy's boat steerer, Thomas Chappell, and 2 teenagers from Cape Cod, Seth Weeks and William Wright, from Pollard's and Chase's boats, respectively. Several times over the last few days, these 3 white off-islanders had been observed reasoning upon the probabilities of their deliverance. And the more they talked about it, the more they dreaded the prospect of climbing back into the whaleboats. Chappell, the once spirited and mischievous Englishman who had set fire to Charles Island, could see that second mate Matthew Joy did not have long to live. As the rest of the crew gradually regained weight and strength during the week on Henderson, Joy, who had possessed a weak and sickly constitution even before the sinking, had remained shockingly thin. Chapel knew that if Joy should die, he would become, by default, his whaleboat's leader, a prospect no reasonable man could relish given what might lie ahead. In preparing for a sea voyage that could result in the deaths of some, if not all, of the men assembled on the beach, the crew of the Essex were reenacting a scenario that had been played out countless times before on islands across the Pacific. The colonization of the Polynesian islands had depended on such scenarios. But instead of a last desperate push to reach a known world, the early South Sea Islanders had set out on voyages of discovery, sailing east and south into the giant blue void of the Pacific. During these long and uncertain passages, starvation inevitably took its toll. The biological anthropologist Stephen McGarvey has speculated that the people who survived these voyages tended to have a higher percentage of body fat before the voyage began and/or more efficient metabolisms, allowing them to live longer on less food than their thinner companions. McGarvey theorizes that this is why modern-day Polynesians suffer from a high incidence of obesity. The same factors that favored fat, metabolically efficient Polynesians were now at work among the crew of the Essex. Although they had all survived on the same rations during their month in the boats, this had not been the case prior to the sinking. As was customary aboard a whale ship, the food served in the forecastle, where the blacks lived, had been a grade below the miserable fare that had been served to the boat steerers and young Nantucketers in steerage. The blacks were also, in all probability, in poorer health than the whites even before they sailed on the Essex. The life expectancy of a black infant in 1900, the earliest date for which there are statistics, was only 33 years, more than 14 years less than that of a white infant. Now, 38 days after the whale attack, it was plain to all that the African Americans, although not as weak as Joy, were faring more poorly than the rest of the crew. At the other extreme were the Nantucketers. Besides being better fed, they had an additional source of strength. They were all from the same close-knit community. The younger Nantucketers had been friends since childhood, while the officers, especially Captain Pollard, demonstrated a fatherly concern for the teenagers' welfare. Whether enduring the torments of thirst and hunger on the boats or foraging for food on Henderson, the Nantucketers provided one another with support and encouragement that they did not offer the others. They had all seen how the man-of-war hawks robbed the tropic birds of their food. As conditions deteriorated on the boats, one could only wonder who of these 9 Nantucketers, 6 African-Americans, and 5 white off-islanders would become the hawks and who would become the tropic birds. Chapel, Wright, and Weeks decided that they did not want to find out. "The rest of us could make no objection to their plan," Chase wrote, "as it lessened the load of our boats and allowed us their share of the provisions. Even the first mate had to admit that the probability of their being able to sustain themselves on the island was much stronger than that of our reaching the mainland." Pollard assured the 3 men that if he did make it back to South America, he would do everything in his power to see that they were rescued. With downcast eyes and trembling lips, the 3 men drew away from the rest of the crew. They'd already picked a spot, well removed from the original encampment, on which to construct a crude shelter out of tree branches. It was time they started work. But their 17 shipmates were reluctant to see them go, offering every little article that could be spared from the boats. After accepting the gifts, Chapel and his 2 companions turned and started down the beach. That evening, Pollard wrote what he assumed would be his last letter home. It was addressed to his wife, Mary, the 20-year-old ropemaker's daughter with whom he had spent the sum total of 57 days of married life. He also wrote another, more public letter. "Account of the loss of the ship Essex of Nantucket in North America, Ducie's Island, December 20, 1820, commanded by Captain Pollard, Jr., which shipwreck happened on the 20th day of November, 1820, on the equator in longitude 120 degrees west, done by a large whale striking her in the bow, which caused her to fill with water in about 10 minutes. We got what provisions and water the boats would carry and left her on the 22nd of November, and arrived here this day with all hands except one black man who left the ship at Tecames. We intend to leave tomorrow, which will be the 26th of December, actually December 27th, 1820, for the continent. I shall leave with this a letter for my wife, and whoever finds and will have the goodness to forward it will oblige an unfortunate man and receive his sincere wishes. George Pollard, Jr. To the west of their encampment they had found a large tree with the name of a ship, the Elizabeth, carved into it. They transformed the tree into a Galapagos-like post office, placing the letters in a small wooden box they nailed to the trunk. On December 27th at 10 o'clock in the morning, by which time the tide had risen far enough to allow the boats to float over the rocks that surrounded the island, they began to load up. In Pollard's boat were his boat steerer, Obed Hendricks, along with their fellow Nantucketers Barzilai Ray, Owen Coffin, and Charles Ramsdell, and the African-American Samuel Reed. Owen Chase's crew was down to five, the Nantucketers Benjamin Lawrence and Thomas Nickerson, along with Richard Peterson, the elderly black from New York, and Isaac Cole, a young white off-islander. Joy's crew contained the white off-islander Joseph West and four blacks, Lawson Thomas, Charles Shorter, Isaiah Shepherd, and the steward, William Bond. Not only were these men under the command of a seriously ill second mate, but Chappell's decision to remain on the island had left them without a boat steerer to assist Joy in the management of the crew. But neither Pollard nor Chase was willing to part with a Nantucket-born boat steerer. Soon it was time for them to leave the island, but Chappell, Wright, and Weeks were nowhere to be found. They had not come down, Chase wrote, either to assist us to get off nor to take any kind of leave of us. The first mate walked down the beach to their dwelling and told them they were about to set sail. The men were, Chase observed, very much affected, and one of them began to cry. They wished us to write to their relations, should Providence safely direct us again to our homes, and said but little else. Seeing that they were ill at heart about taking any leave of us, Chase bid them a hasty goodbye and left for the boats. They followed me with their eyes, he wrote, until I was out of sight, and I never saw more of them. Before leaving the island, the men in the boats decided to backtrack a bit and sail to a beach they had seen during their original circuit of the island. It had looked like a spot that might be productive of some unexpected good fortune, possibly providing them with fresh provisions for the start of their journey. After dropping half a dozen men on shore to search for food, the rest of them spent the day fishing. They saw several sharks but were unable to catch anything save a few mackerel-sized fish. The shore party returned at about 6 o'clock that evening with some more birds, and they made final preparations to leave. It had been more of a tease than a salvation, but Henderson Island had at least given them a fighting chance. Back on December 20th, Chase had seen death itself staring us in the face. Now, after more than a week of food and drink, their casks were full of fresh water. Their boats no longer leaked. In addition to hardtack, each crew had some fish and birds. There were also three fewer men to support. "We again set sail," Nickerson wrote, "finally leaving this land which had been so providentially thrown in our way." Chapter 10. The Whisper of Necessity. Before they left Henderson Island, Chase loaded a flat stone and an armful of firewood into each boat. That first evening back on the water, as both the island and the sun slipped below the western horizon behind them, they put the stones to use as platforms for cooking fires. "We kept our fires going," Chase wrote, "and cooked our fish and birds, and felt our situation as comfortable as could be expected." For a month, they had been driven south and even west. Now they hoped to sail almost directly east to Easter Island. For this to happen, they needed 2 weeks of westerly breezes. However, at latitude 24 degrees south, they were still in the trades, where for more than 70% of the year the wind blows out of the southeast. But that night, as if in answer to their prayers, a strong breeze sprang up out of the northwest, and they steered straight for Easter. If they were to keep track of their progress east, they needed to find a way to estimate their longitude, something they had not done during the first leg of the voyage. A month of sailing without knowing their east-to-west position had proved to them the necessity of at least attempting to determine it. Before leaving Henderson, they decided to maintain what Chase called a regular reckoning. Their noon observation told them their latitude, and by doing as Captain Bligh had done before them, using an improvised log line to gauge their speed and their compass to determine their direction, they could calculate their longitude. The Essex boats were no longer sailing blind. For 3 days, the northwesterly breeze held. Then on December 30th, the wind shifted into the east-southeast, and for 2 days they were forced to steer a course well to the south of Easter Island. But by the first day of the new year, 1821, the wind had shifted to the north, and they were once again back on track. On January 3rd, they sailed into what Nickerson called hard weather. Squalls blasted them from the southwest. The seas had become so rough, Nickerson remembered, that we were fearful that each successive gust would swamp our boats. Every squall was attended with the most vivid flashes of lightning and awful thunderclaps, which seemed to cause the very bosom of the deep to tremble and threw a cheerless aspect upon the face of the ocean. The next day, the capricious wind shifted to the east-northeast. With their sails trimmed in tight on the port tack, they steered as close to the wind as possible, but were still unable to fetch Easter Island. Pollard and Chase came to the same distressing conclusion. They were now too far to the south to have any hope of reaching the island. They searched their navigator copies for the next closest island, where the wind would allow of our going. About 800 miles off the Chilean coast are the islands of Juan Fernandez and Masafuera. Unfortunately, there were more than 2,500 miles between them and these islands, farther than they had sailed since leaving the Essex 44 days before. On the same day that they abandoned all hope of reaching Easter Island, they ate the last of their fish and birds. It was back to their daily ration of a cup of water and 3 ounces of hardtack per man. For the next 2 days, the wind deserted them. The sun beat down with the same withering force that had so oppressed them prior to their arrival at Henderson. The conditions were the hardest on Matthew Joy, whose bowels had ceased to function. Ever since leaving the island, he had continued to deteriorate, and his glassy, distracted eyes had taken on the unmistakable look of death. On January 7th, a breeze rose up out of the north. Their noon observation revealed they had slipped almost 6 degrees of latitude, or 360 nautical miles, to the south. But it was their progress to the east that most concerned them. They estimated that they were now only 600 miles closer to the mainland than when they had left Henderson 11 days before. The next day, Matthew Joy made a request. The 27-year-old second mate asked if he might be moved to the captain's boat. The transfer was effected, Chase wrote, under the impression that he would be more comfortable there, and more attention and pains be bestowed in nursing and endeavoring to comfort him. But all knew the real reason for the second mate's removal. Now that he was reaching the end, Joy, who had been on a boat with 5 coofs, wanted to die among his own people. Joy came from an old Quaker family. Near the town hall on Nantucket, his grandfather had owned a large house that was still referred to as the Reuben Joy Homestead. In 1800, when Matthew was only 7 years old, his parents moved the family to Hudson, New York, where Nantucketers had established a whaling port soon after the Revolution. Matthew remained a friend until 1817, when he returned to his native island to wed 19-year-old Nancy Slade, a Congregationalist. As was customary in such cases, he was disowned that year by the Nantucket Monthly Meeting for marrying out. Joy was no longer a Quaker, but on January 10th, a hot, windless day in the Pacific, he demonstrated a friend's sense of duty and devotion. For the last 2 days, his boat crew had been left leaderless. He now asked to be returned to them. His loyalty to his crew was, in the end, greater than his need for comfort from his fellow Nantucketers. The transfer was made, and by 4 o'clock that afternoon, Matthew Joy was dead. Nantucket's Quaker graveyard was without worldly monuments of any kind, and many had compared its smooth, unmarred sweep to the anonymous surface of the sea. Like that graveyard thousands of miles away, the sea that morning was calm and smooth. Not a breath of air ruffled the Pacific's slow, rhythmic swell. The three boats were brought together, and after sewing Joy up in his clothes, they tied a stone to his feet and consigned him in a solemn manner to the ocean. Even though they knew Joy had been ill for quite some time, his loss hit them hard. "It was an incident," Chase wrote, "which threw a gloom over our feelings for many days." The last 2 weeks had been particularly difficult for the men on the second mate's boat. Instead of drawing strength and inspiration from their leader, they had been required to expend valuable energy nursing him. Making it even harder was the absence of Joy's boat steerer, Thomas Chapel. To fill the void, Pollard ordered his own boat steerer, the 21-year-old Obed Hendricks, to take command of the second mate's shaken and dispirited crew. Soon after taking over the steering oar, Hendricks made a disturbing discovery. Joy's illness had apparently prevented him from closely monitoring the distribution of his boat's provisions. As best as Hendricks could determine, there was only enough hardtack in his boat's cuddy to last 2, maybe 3 more days. Throughout the morning and afternoon of the following day, the 52nd since the men had left the Essex, the wind built out of the northwest until by nightfall it was blowing a full gale. The men took in all sail and steered their boats before the wind. Even without a stitch of canvas set, the boats surfed wildly down the crests of the waves. "Flashes of lightning were quick and vivid," Chase wrote, "and the rain came down in cataracts." Instead of being terrified, the men were exhilarated to know that each 50-knot gust was blowing them toward their destination. "Although the danger was very great," Nickerson remembered, "yet none seemed to dread this so much as death by starvation, and I believe none would have exchanged this terrific gale for a more moderate headwind or a calm." Visibility was low that night in the driving rain. They had agreed that in the event they became separated, they would steer a course of east-southeast in the hope that they would be within sight of one another come daybreak. As usual, Chase was in the lead. Every minute or so, he turned his head to make sure he could see the other two boats. But at around 11 o'clock, he glanced back and saw nothing. "It was blowing and raining at this time as if the heavens were separating," he wrote, "and I knew not hardly at the moment what to do." He decided to head up into the wind and hove to. After drifting for about an hour, expecting every moment that they would come up with us, Chase and his men resumed their agreed-upon course, hopeful that, as had happened before, they would sight the other boats in the morning. "As soon as daylight appeared," Nickerson wrote, "every man in our boat raised himself, searching the waters. Grabbing the masts and one another for support, they stood up on the seats, craning their necks for a glimpse of their lost companions on the wave-fringed horizon. But they had disappeared." "It was folly to repine at the circumstances," Chase commented. "It could neither be remedied, nor could sorrow secure their return. But it was impossible to prevent ourselves feeling all the poignancy and bitterness that characterizes the separation of men who have long suffered in each other's company, and whose interests and feelings fate had so closely linked together." They were at latitude 32 degrees 16 minutes south, longitude 112 degrees 20 minutes west, about 600 miles south of Easter Island. 19 days from Henderson, with more than 1,000 miles still left to go, Chase and his men were alone. For many days after this accident, our progress was attended with dull and melancholy reflections, he wrote. We had lost the cheering of each other's faces, that which, strange as it is, we so much required in both our mental and bodily distresses. The squalls and rain continued through the next day. Chase decided to take an inventory of their remaining provisions. Thanks to his rigorous supervision, they still had a considerable store of bread left. But they had been 54 days at sea, and there were more than 1,200 miles between them and the island of Juan Fernandez. Necessity began to whisper to us, Chase wrote, that a still further reduction of our allowance must take place, or we must abandon altogether the hopes of reaching the land and rely wholly on the chance of being taken up by a vessel. They were already on half provisions, eating only 3 ounces of bread a day. How to reduce the daily quantity of food with any regard to life itself was a question of the utmost consequence. 3 ounces of hardtack provided them with only 250 calories a day, less than 15% of their daily needs. Chase told his men that they had no choice but to cut these half rations once again to only 1.5 ounces of bread a day. This, he knew, must in short time reduce us to mere skeletons again. It was a terrifying dilemma, and Chase did not arrive at the decision easily. It required a great effort to bring matters to this dreadful alternative, he wrote. Either feed our bodies and our hopes a little longer, or in the agonies of hunger to seize upon and devour our provisions and coolly await the approach of death. Somewhere to the north of them, their companions were about to discover the consequences of taking the latter course. The men in Pollard's and Hendricks' boats were just as gravely affected by the separation. They continued on, however, almost confident that they would once again meet up with Chase's boat. That day, January 14th, Obed Hendricks' boat ran out of provisions. For Hendricks and his 5 crew members, Joseph West, Lawson Thomas, Charles Shorter, Isaiah Shepard, and William Bond, the question was whether Pollard would be willing to share his boat's provisions. Having placed Hendricks in command of the second mate's boat only 3 days before, Pollard could not easily deny his former boat steerer some of his own stock of food. And if he was willing to feed Hendricks, he would have to feed the other 5. So Pollard and his men shared with them what little bread they had, knowing full well that in only a few more days there would be nothing left. Chase's separation from Pollard and Hendricks saved the first mate from having to face this painful predicament. From the beginning, Chase had strictly, even obsessively, attended to the distribution of rations aboard his boat. To throw open his sea chest of provisions to Hendricks' men, all of them off-islanders who had begun the ordeal with the same amount of bread as his crew, would have been, from Chase's perspective, an act of collective suicide. Earlier in the ordeal, the men had discussed the possibility of having to share their provisions if one of the crews should lose their stock. Such a course of conduct, Chase wrote, was calculated to weaken the chances of a final deliverance for some, and might be the only means of consigning every soul of us to a horrid death of starvation. For Chase, intent on getting himself and his boat crew to safety, no matter what, the separation from Pollard's and Hendricks' boats could not have been better timed. On the same day that Chase cut his crew's daily ration of bread in half, the wind gradually died to nothing. The clouds thinned until the sun's rays once again became overwhelming. In desperation, Chase and his men tore the sails from the spars and hid beneath the salt-encrusted canvas. Swaddling themselves in the sails, they lay down in the bottom of the boat and abandoned her, the first mate wrote, to the mercy of the waves. Despite the severity of the sun, the men did not complain of thirst. After a week of drinking their fill at Henderson Island, they had been rehydrated to the extent that food had replaced water as their most desperate need. In fact, some of the men were now suffering from diarrhea, a common symptom of starvation, which Chase attributed to the relaxing effects of the water. As he put it, we were fast wasting away. While the body can rebound quite quickly from dehydration, it takes a frustratingly long time to recover from the effects of starvation. During World War II, the University of Minnesota's Laboratory of Physiological Hygiene conducted what scientists and relief workers still regard today as a benchmark study of starvation. Partly funded by religious groups, including the Society of Friends, the study was intended to help the Allies cope with released concentration camp internees, prisoners of war, and refugees. The participants were all conscientious objectors who volunteered to lose 25% of their body weight over 6 months. The experiment was supervised by Dr. Ansel Keys, for whom the K ration was named. The volunteers lived a spare but comfortable existence at a stadium on the campus of the University of Minnesota. Although meager, their carefully measured rations of potatoes, turnips, rutabagas, dark bread, and macaroni, similar to the kinds of foods refugees might scavenge during wartime, possessed a wide variety of vitamins and minerals. Yet despite the clinically safe circumstances of the environment, the volunteers suffered severe physiological and psychological distress. As they lost weight, the men became lethargic in both body and spirit. They became increasingly irritable. Concentration became difficult. They were appalled at their lack of physical strength and coordination, and many suffered blackouts when they stood up quickly. Their limbs swelled. They lost their sexual desire and would indulge instead in a kind of stomach masturbation, describing favorite meals to one another and poring over cookbooks for hours at a time. They complained of losing all sense of initiative and creativity. Many of the so-called American characteristics, a chronicler of the experiment wrote, abounding energy, generosity, optimism, become intelligible as the expected behavior response of a well-fed people. For many of the men, the most difficult part of the experiment was the recovery period. Weeks after increasing their food intake, they still felt hunger cravings. In some cases, they actually lost weight during their first week off the starvation diet. If the findings of the Minnesota study apply, the Essex cruise week on Henderson did little to restore their body's reserves of muscle and fat. Now, 3 weeks later, the sailors were as close to starving to death as they'd ever been. The symptoms the men suffered as their boats lay becalmed on January 14, 1821, were similar to those experienced by the conscientious objectors in 1945. Chase reported that they barely had the strength to move about in our boats and slowly perform the necessary labors appertaining to them. That evening, when they sat up from the bottom of the boat, they experienced the same kind of blackouts that afflicted the men at the University of Minnesota. Upon our attempting to rise again, Chase wrote, the blood would rush into the head and an intoxicating blindness come over us, almost to occasion our suddenly falling down again. Chase's sufferings were so severe that he forgot to lock the lid of his sea chest before falling asleep in the bottom of the boat. That night, one of the crew awoke the first mate and informed him that Richard Peterson, the old black man from New York who had led them all in prayer, had stolen some bread. Chase leaped up in a rage. I felt at the moment the highest indignation and resentment at such conduct in any of our crew, he wrote, and immediately took my pistol in my hand and charged him, if he had taken any bread, to give it up without the least hesitation or I should instantly shoot him. Peterson immediately returned the provisions, pleading, Chase wrote, the hard necessity that urged him to do it. Almost three times the age of anyone else in the boat, Peterson was reaching the end of his endurance, and he knew that without more bread, he would soon die. Nonetheless, the first mate felt that an example had to be made. This was the first infraction, he wrote, and the security of our lives, our hopes of redemption from our sufferings, loudly called for a prompt and signal punishment. But as Nickerson observed, Peterson was a good old man, and nothing but the cravings of a starved appetite could have induced him to be guilty of so rash an attempt. Chase finally decided to grant him mercy. I could not find it in my soul to extend towards him the least severity on this account, he wrote, however much according to the strict imposition which we felt upon ourselves it might demand. Chase warned Peterson that if he attempted to steal again, it would cost him his life. Light breezes persisted throughout the next day and into the following night. The tensions among Chase's crew had begun to ease, but their individual suffering continued unabated, their bodies racked by a hunger that the daily ration of an ounce and a half of bread hardly began to alleviate. Still, the distribution of provisions remained the most important part of the day. Some of the men attempted to make their portion last as long as possible, nibbling it almost daintily and savoring each tiny morsel with what little saliva their mouths could generate. Others ate their ration virtually whole, hoping to provide their stomachs with at least some sensation of fullness. Afterward, all of them fastidiously licked the residue from their fingers. That night, the placid waters around Chase's boat suddenly erupted into pale foam as something enormous slammed into the stern. Clinging to the gunwales, the men rose up from the bottom of the boat and saw that a shark, nearly as large as the killer whale that had attacked Pollard's boat, was swimming about us in a most ravenous manner, making attempts every now and then upon different parts of the boat, as if he would devour the very wood. The monster snapped at the steering oar, then tried to get its massive jaws around the boat's stern post, as if possessed by the same gnawing hunger that was consuming all of them. In the bottom of the boat was a lance, just like the one Chase had been tempted to hurl at the whale that sank the Essex. If they could kill this giant shark, they'd have enough food to last them for several weeks. But when Chase attempted to stab the creature, he discovered that he did not have the strength even to dent its sandpaper-like skin. He was so much larger than an ordinary shark, Chase wrote, and manifested such a fearless malignity as to make us afraid of him, and our utmost efforts, which were at first directed to kill him for prey, became in the end self-defense. There was little the men could do as the shark pushed and slapped their whaleboat's thin sides. Eventually the shark grew bored with them. Baffled in all his hungry attempts upon us, Chase wrote, he shortly made off. The next day, a group of porpoises replaced the shark. For almost an hour, Chase's men did everything they could to catch one of these playful creatures. Whenever a porpoise surfaced near the boat, they tried to stab it with a lance. But as had been true with the shark, they could not, in Nickerson's words, muster strength sufficient to pierce through their tough hide. While a shark is a primitive killing machine, a porpoise is one of the most intelligent mammals on Earth. The porpoise's mastery of their environment was now cruelly obvious to this boatload of starving land dwellers. They soon left us, Nickerson wrote, apparently in high glee, leaping from the water and in full exercise of every enjoyment. Poor devils, how much they are now our superiors and yet not know it. For the next 2 days, January 17th and 18th, the calms returned. The distresses of a cheerless prospect and a burning hot sun were, Chase wrote, once again visited upon our devoted heads. As they approached their 60th day since leaving the Essex, even Chase had become convinced that it was their destiny to die. We began to think that divine providence had abandoned us at last, the first mate wrote, and it was but an unavailing effort to endeavor to prolong a now tedious existence. They could not help but wonder how they would die. Horrible were the feelings that took possession of us. The contemplation of a death of agony and torment, refined by the most dreadful and distressing reflections, absolutely prostrated both